Second, for the instructions that John Bart gives to King Rukmuna. So this whole incident is leading up to that. King Rukmuna is very proud, and he identifies himself as a king. And he doesn't recognize the devotee of the Lord. Of course, it's difficult for a materialist to recognize a devotee. At best, a materialist will recognize another person in the material world who has a high material position. But to recognize a devotee is much more difficult. And to recognize a devotee who's very, very elevated, such as Jhanavara, is difficult. And it's certainly difficult even for devotees in many cases. So, therefore, we can't blame Rahula too much for his fault. But nevertheless, we do see that he was definitely identifying very strongly with his own body and his identity as a king. So this is material identity is a sign of our stubbornness in the material world, our stubbornness in the refusal to recognize the Supreme Lord. So often we'll see in the Bhagavatam how pride and criticized, and pride is related to position and wealth. So we see that the two sons of Kuvera were, because they were the sons of Kuvera, who was the god, demigod of money, and they were very proud. And therefore, they didn't recognize or pay any attention to Narada Muni when he came there. And they were playing around in the water with some women. So they disrespected Narada Muni and didn't honor him properly. So Narada Muni cursed them. So in relation to that, Narada Muni gives a whole lecture on how accumulation of wealth leads to pride. And then pride leads to all sorts of problems in this world. So it leads to material problems, and it also is covers up any possibility of spiritual life. And for that reason, often that phrase pratishtha, or desire for position, which is a way of pride and things like that, and fame, is considered to be a great stumbling block for the devotees, those who are progressing in devotion and service. So the reason is that this pride is simply a manifestation of this strong material identity and the refusal to give up that. And therefore we see what is the 10th apparatus of the holy name. And in spite of all hearing of the Lord is the name, that we very quickly attach to our material concepts, our material position, our material attachments, which is we can summarize as aham and mama. Aham is the material identity we have, and mama is our possession, our desire to gather things for ourselves. So if this is very strong, it becomes actually an offense to the chanting of the holy name, temple offense. So it's that even if you give up avoid all the other offenses, if you have this strong sense of ahamama, then you cannot progress in the devotional service. So very, very strong warnings given about this identity, which is illustrated by the story of the boatman. So the boatman is paid money to take the wedding party up the river. So everyone very nicely gets on the boat in the evening time, and they plan out that, okay, we'll sleep in the boat, have a nice party at night, go to sleep, and in the morning the boatman will take us up the river, and then sunrises, we look at the village, said, go to the next village, and we have the wedding. So they pay the boatman to go up the river, and they'll get up and have a nice time at night, and they'll go to sleep. And then they get up in the morning expecting to be in the village, and when the mist rises and the sun rises, and they look up, hey, we're in the same place. So they're shocked, and they go to the boat and say, gee, you were stuck all night. And the boat said, I didn't sleep. I was talking about the river like a swamp patch. And then someone looked in the boat, and there was an anchor, and the anchor was still in the thing. It was all night long like this, but the boat was going nowhere. And you can understand what it was dark about. But because the anchor was in it, the boat didn't go anywhere. So similarly, if you have the strong material desires, strong material possessive instincts, and we don't want to get rid of our attachments and hold on to those material attachments, we do emotional service, we stay in the same place. We don't progress. Of course, we also know that bhakti is through the bhakti that we get Arjuna Vritti and we get the Nishtha. It's not so true. But before that, this was the beginning of bhakti, with the faith in the beginning of bhakti, we do have to have some preliminary resolution to give up whatever attachments we have, understanding that they are detrimental for our progress. We may not be able to give them up completely. We can't anyway, because the Narjanavarti is a gradual process all the way into bhava stage. But still, if we have no resolution at all giving these things up, then it's impossible to give up. But if we do have a resolution to give up a form of bhakti, then gradually they will, all the anarthas will dissipate. But if we hold on to our anarthas and we practice bhakti, what can we do? We can't progress. If we deliberately hold on to all the anarthas and indulge them, then we cannot progress. So we do have to have some determination. It's not favorable for us. One of the aspects of surrender or shamanagati is what we do is favorable, we reject what is unfavorable. So we have to reject all of these anarthas. We cannot completely give them up, but at least we try to give them up and make a determination to do so. And by the practice of bhakti, then they'll gradually be dissipated. And then anarthas will be takes place. But if we have no determination to give anything up in the material world, we can't go anywhere. Yeah. I think in the Chaitanya Bhagavad, the example is given of if you have these material attachments and you expect all the joy in the material world, at the same time I will go to the spiritual world. Try to do both. And we have no determination to reject the material world at all. The example is given there of two boats on the river. Small boats, of course, like the ones on the Jalangi River, boats. They have two boats, and a person has one foot in one boat and the other foot in another boat. So this is an impossible position. You can't have both things. One boat or the other, not half in one boat, half in another boat. So if you can even have both 2 feet in two boats, and eventually the boats separate and just go in the water. So similarly, if you're trying to enjoy the material world and go to Krishna at the same time, it doesn't work. You fail. So, we do have material attachments, and we're not expected to completely somehow make them disappear, because that's impossible. But at least that determination has to be there. So we do what's favorable for bhakti, avoid what's unfavorable as much as possible. And we have the 10th upper rod, not to be overly attached to the material things. On the contrary, we have Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentions in the Parinatha Chandra, the 10th upper rod is there. So the opposite of that, that's the upper, don't be attached to material things. The opposite is that Sharanagati, where we accept what's favorable, what is unfavorable. And in this way we kind of surrender to the Lord and do what's favorable and not indulge our material attachments too much. Then we can advance in devotional service. So that is the basis of bhakti. So in this case here we see King Mahuguna as this very strong attachment to his idea. I'm the king, and you have to listen to what I say, and if you don't listen, I'll punish you. And then you should carry the alapa very nicely, because I'm the king, and I have my comforts, and if you don't listen to me, it means you're a fool, and I'll have to punish you. So, he has a very strong identity with his position of a king, and he wants to exert his power over others to see that he gets his enjoyment. So this is the general tendency of people in this world. People may not be so gross as Kivaruka, but nevertheless, everybody has their own particular type of life that they're living, and they're very attached to that particular mode in which they live. And anyone tries to disturb it, then they get served. Whatever that position is, may not even be a very high position, but literally, according to what they say, is comfortable. And then somebody disturbs it, then they get very agitated and blame the other person. So this is the nature of material life. It's also, you say, the nature even of animals. We can say that the lower instincts and the lower habits of human beings are actually the same as the animal instincts and habits. In other words, the animal also very attached to something, like the dog. He's got his own area, but if you come to his area, you bark. You take it, as soon as you come to his area, you get too close to bark. all animals will exhibit similar propensities, very, very attached to their survival, to their material bodies, and if anyone threatens that, then they get very agitated, which is good for survival in this material world. So the human being, of course, does need to survive, does need to get his food and water, defense, whatever. House and clothing, whatever all these things he needs. So these are the animal purposes, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. And the human being also has the right to do that like the animals. But human beings expected to do more than that. That yes, we need that, but we shouldn't concentrate on that as the only goal in life, and have that as the only satisfaction in life. And ultimately, it isn't. And most people realize that. That no matter how much of this material satisfaction they get, they know that they're not complete with that material, whatever they get. It doesn't really satisfy people. So this is the nature of the human being. It's different now. So therefore, his nature is to strive for something else. But what that is the difficult thing, because normal society is not really explicitly stated. However, if you look in the Vedic literature, it is very directly stated in all places. So if you look in Bhagavad Gita in chapter 2, Arjuna is confused. Should I fight? Should I not fight? Fight so many problems and difficulties, and if I don't fight, then Krishna says that's also wrong. That's going to cause problems too. So then, whatever you do, you're stuck. So then, Krishna says immediately, hey, you're not a body at all. Nothing to do with this body. Don't be attached to anything here. It has to do with your body, your relationships with other people, friends and enemies, etc. Money, wealth, Swargaloka, kingdom. All this is grandfather or whatever, all these relationships, and it's all material concept, and it's all illusory. So from the very beginning of Bhagavad Gita, we have a very clear indication that all these material goals that we have are useless. Ultimately, they will not give satisfaction to us. They're useful, only in the fact that they allow us to continue our life, so that we can use that in life for higher goals. That's it. So, unfortunately, most people don't understand that. But as I said, the Vedic literature is very clear in this respect. From the very beginning. Bhagavad Gita, the goal is indicated. It's nothing in the material world. It's actually your spiritual identity. And that's the basis of real happiness. And this course is elaborated in the Bhagavad and other Vedic literatures. So this is the key to happiness for the human being. Animal, they don't have to worry about it. Human beings cannot be happy with this position. So therefore, King Lahuna, with all of his power and his slaves or whatever, and his palanquin and everything, cannot really be happy with all that. The thing is, he has to get out of that material conception. As I said, it's natural for the human being that they will understand this to some degree, but it's very unclear to most people, and therefore they go throughout their life and they never really realize what's happening until they're dead, until they're dying. But then they go, I've always thought, what do I do this for? And then they start asking the question, it's too late. It's too late when they're dying. What did I do with my life? And then it's too late. They die. And they start all over again next time. Everything, and when they're dying, they remember a little bit, why did I do this? And then they forget. Next lifetime. So this goes on like this. So it's disastrous. And so that is why the whole of Vedic society is organized with that spiritual goal, Artha Dharma Kama, and Moksha. It is inherent there. From the very bottom, even for the Sutra, that these two will understand, yeah, there is a Moksha there somewhere. So that's the whole goal of that whole Arnashram system, even though it's a material system. The goal is get out of the material world, because you're not the body. So implicit in that whole system, for all people, even if they're in the mode of ignorance, is the fact that the goal is ultimately not material, it's spiritual. And is that people can get a little bit of that realization, or a little knowledge of that, even in the beginning of their life, is at the bottom of the Brahmas. Some time ago in the Sutra, still, it's beneficial for them, and they can live more peacefully. So, that is inculcated there. But then, it is not laid out in detail. Okay, material world is a loser, you have to get out of the material world, you're not more in the material body. And basic information is there in chapter 2 of Bhagavad Gita. But that's not the complete knowledge. So if you really want complete knowledge, you have to go further. And more complete knowledge is given in Bhagavad. But anyway, that's the beginning stage. At least we're not the body, we are the soul, the Atma, different from the material body. And you see in the teachings of Jhagavara, again, he starts out like that. You're not the body, you identify with the material body, you're a fool, because this material life is useless, so you have to begin to inquire about spiritual life. So he starts out very genuinely in that way. But eventually he goes beyond that as well. So we have stage one of spiritual life, and that's you're not the body, you're the soul, you're eternal. And beyond this limitation of the material body. But it's quickly at that level. And if you're in Sakta womb, then it's quite easy to do that. To get to the next level, it's more difficult to comprehend. And because it's not just a result of Sakta womb. It's only a result of mercy of devotees. So by mercy of devotees, we develop Shraddha, our faith. By faith, then we understand that not only there is a jiva or an atma, but there is a supreme lord. So to come to that stage is rare, much rarer. And it's only through the mercy of devotees that we can get that. So that is an important stage, because this is the completion of the human being. First stage is, we're stuck in the material world acting on animals. Second stage is, Karma Yoga Varnashram, where we at least understand this is spiritual goal, and working in the law and being upwards. We follow the rules of Sudhir, Vaishya, Shakya, Brahman. When we get to the top stage, Brahma, and then we something, and we understand I'm not the body, I'm the soul. And we start sitting Vedic lectures, Vedanta, etc. to understand. But then to go further than that, it's not automatic. It's only mercy of the folks at that point. So to get from probably wouldn't do rupture when you can do that, and disruptive when you can do that through gradual restriction of rules and rules within the Maharashtra system. To get a bhakti, you need the devotees, the mercy of the devotees. That mercy is such that it is not dependent on goodness. In other words, Jan Bharat can give mercy to King Bhuvan, but he's not a Brahmin. He's a chapter who's really stuck in his pride and position. Yeah. Or he could give it to Sudra or to a Vaishya or anybody not in the Varnashram system also. He could give it to anybody. So the devotee is merciful to all people, wherever they are in the material world. If he's merciful to them, then they go beyond sattva. They go beyond realization of And they understand the relationship of jiva with Supreme Lord and the form bhakti. So that is the highest position, but this is a little rare because it just depends on the devotees of the Lord. It doesn't depend on the social system. Depends on the mercy of the devotees. So, fortunately, of course, the devotees are very merciful and they like to spread bhakti everywhere. But still, some people are qualified, some people aren't qualified. So, therefore, as I said, don't preach to the faithless people. So, therefore, we only preach to a certain limited amount of people directly, as Chandra speaks to Raghunath, that's direct preaching. But some are not qualified for that, so you cannot preach to them. So, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is more merciful. Says, even the unqualified people should get the mercy. Though we say that don't preach to the faithless people, and give them, so it can't be mercy to the demons or anything like that. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, even the unqualified people, even the people without faith, even the people who are already, should get mercy. So we get a little contradiction there. Don't preach to the faithless people. Bhagavad Gita also says that don't preach Bhagavad Gita to the people who are envious. Only to those who have faith. So the word how mercy goes up. But then Lord Chaitanya says, no, let's give to everybody, give everybody's. Anyway, so then he has this other method that is Nama Sankirtan. But of course, within the ten apparatus of the holy name, the Nama Paradigma, don't preach the faithless, don't preach the glories of the holy name of the faithless people also, or to the demons. So it looks like a limitation there. So then the solution to this, how we give out mercy, is that we don't preach directly to them, but the preaching consists of letting them hear the name of Krishna. Exactly that. Let them hear it. We don't have to give them teaching, let them hear it. Or other things also, like Prasadam, let them hear Prasadam, let them hear the holy name, whatever, something like that. That much you can do. So that's how you deliver the people who don't have any faith. You just expose them to Krishna somehow or other. And by the constant exposure, eventually they change and they develop faith. When they get faith, then you can directly reach them and all follow the people, otherwise, before they don't do too much. So that's the way in which one preaches to the people in general. So that is through the non sankirtan movement. It is open for everybody, and even the people who are unfavorable. Demons and people without faith, they can also hear, and by that hearing, they will get some mercy, get some advancements. So, through the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the mercy is open, more general for all types of people, even the apparatus. And therefore, the process of bhakti becomes not so rare. Because through Nama Sankirtan, you have available to everybody. So in this way, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is hoping to uplift the whole world and make them into devotees. So to get back to the idea of the pride here, that pride is a manifestation of their false ego and their material identity, and ultimately their great attachment to their enjoyment within the material world. Well, that's very, very strong, and very, very difficult to preach to such a person. However, as I said, by exposure to the mercy, eventually people, even those persons, can change. And if the devotee is very advanced, then he has special powers by which he can elevate people. So that's why we have the Kapasiddha. The devotee, how does he get that? Because of the mercy of Krishna, or mercy of the devotee. So the devotee is very merciful, and suddenly the devotee can advance, even if he's at no stage zero, he can advance quickly. That's in the case of Vrindavan. Not only are they great devotees, but they have great shakti, great power to elevate people. So sometimes great devotees have that power to quickly elevate people, even if they're very, very unqualified. So, of course, Lord Chaitanya, because he is pretty modern on Krishna, therefore he had great power. And then he would just wander around from Puri, he went down to South India, and then he was in capital, and in capital, and people would all start crying about prema very, very quickly. So it was not so difficult. He was just distributing prema everywhere. Of course, the devotees after that, not so powerful, but nevertheless, there is some of that shakti by the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Krishna. I do have some shakti, some powers there, so that people can more quickly advance and get rid of their material coverings, as we see here in the case of the king. Not very qualified for bhakti, but because Jayavara was great devotee of the Lord and great shakti, he was able to convince the king, and the king heard very nicely his instructions and gave up his material possessions. In the material world, the devotees are fighting against this material conception of the materialistic people. And we fight against that by this the shakti of bhakti, and of course the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So if we put our endeavors in that direction, then we can very easily channel that shakti of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and that can have great effect on the people in this world. So we should be open to the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and then we can distribute bhakti to all sorts of people. Okay.
One question regarding preaching to the faithless, like I have one question regarding preaching to the faithless. So you mentioned that if persons are too ignorant and have no faith at all, and usually don't preach them directly or Bhagavad Gita, you just expose them to the holy name of the Shabbat. And actually, I noticed that in the Western outreach programs, is the system that we follow. We give prasadam and kirtan. Don't preach too much, but not ready. But I know some of the solutions different. Remember, we meet, given Bhagavad Gita.
Well, if you give a Bhagavad Gita and they take it, that means they are a little favorable already, otherwise they wouldn't even look at the book. Stay away from you, stay away from devotees, not talk to them at all. But they are a little curious, which means they've developed to a certain degree, so you can say they have a little bit of faith at that point, if they were willing to take a book and read it, whatever, so these are a little things there. One of the things that people don't have faith, so really they look at a book and they run away. Or they throw things at you or like that, but that those are holes. So we don't even try to distribute books to those people.
I noticed even in Sri Mahavita there's two ways. There's one way which is real honest.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you can trick them. Is that okay?
Well, that's something like we have a super event. Where we give the prasadam, they don't ask prasadam, and then they eat it, and then they get some benefit that way. So that's one way, of course, you can do things. But then they backfire also, because if they realize they get tricked them and they did not even read anything, or maybe more hostile, so it's a little dangerous. So, which is probably what happened in America in the early days of distribution. They tricked a lot of people and they got a very bad name for that.
So it's better not to trick them. Is it to draw the line, or should we only distribute books sincerely, like honestly, or like for someone I said that I try to distribute a book on the merit of the book. But then sometimes if I'm in the area and it doesn't work, then sometimes I make it very creative.
Well, somehow or other, we can invoke their attraction for Krishna or favorability by one thing or other, the words or pictures or something like that. This is nothing wrong with that. As long as we're not dishonest in our ultimate presentation.
Okay. Right. All right, we understand from this pastime here that they are meant to elevate us spiritually. But if you keep aside spiritual part and we see he was a king and he's a representative of a god, he was just asking a perfect service from his servant. He was just saying, like, why you are not keeping the pancreas so perfectly?
Mm-hmm.
So being as his GP, he was doing it because mm-hmm. he was feeling, I'm not feeling okay here. Please do it properly.
Yes.
So how do we understand that, he's not doing his job okay here, the king?
Well, yeah, in one sense, of course, he is doing his duty by chastising the servants of the Navadvipa properly. That's a wonderful. On the other level, of course, if you look at it on a higher level, you'll see that ultimately he and the people carrying the palanquin also, but all the bodily concept. Both of them are bodily concept. One is in the higher position, one is in the lower position. And whether he's completely involved in his identity or not, we don't know for sure. But because he did ultimately offend Chalabar, you see what he would have could really do spiritually, yes. Because he just insulted him about anything. To which Chalabar replied in a very interesting way. Yes, he should his duty as a king. But all these duties that we have, even if we go through the Varnashram system, they're all with material identities, whether you're Sattva, whether you're Kama Guna, and you're Brahma, Vajra, Kshatriya, Sudra. It's all material identity attached to it. So therefore, we shouldn't get attached even to Sattva or being Brahma. That's also another upadi, it's another covering, it's another type of ego. And so, it's all ego, whatever it is. But within that, then we have the duties and rules of Varnashram. So within those gunas, within those material identities, you work in a certain way, then you can gradually advance if you do your duties properly. So the king, if he does his duties properly, fine, he can advance and eventually get himself to look. But if you're a king, then as a kshatriya, you're not going to put the rajaguna. You're going to have sattva. Kshatriya is a mixture of sattva guna and rajaguna. And the sattva portion allows him to give respect to the brahmanas, to study scriptures, as you see that tradition on the rear, do this to your very, very knowledgeable scriptures. And that's a sattva portion coming through. So whatever rajaguna tendencies they have to control people, this is the character rajaguna meant to, Ishvara Baba, to control people. But then the other thing is that they do have the sattva portion that allows them to respect the higher authorities of the Brahmins and scriptures, etc., and to act with wisdom. So there's a little balance that's not completely rajaguna control. So they have to use their power discreetly.
As a leader, they also need to be expert at preaching, so they can affect the, like if somebody comes to our temple, someone in the position of the leadership, they talk to the local employees, and they can also say in a way that I feel good about that,
mm-hmm.
I want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like I'm neither, so I have kids who do very heavy. So, you know, there's also a way to preach Krishna consciousness that is very suitable and
sweet.
Like the use of vocal cords and body language, and it's not that it's spiritual, so it can be like, you know, the body and the patients, they put you right off.
So the, of course, as devotees, we may take certain positions, and like chakra positions, or Rama positions, or Vajra, or Shudra, or whatever, but those are all superficial, and then those, we're just doing work, as a laborer, or a money-making work, or an angel work, or a philosopher work, within those categories, but ultimately, we're all devotees, so therefore, that takes precedence over all of these other modes of conduct. We're not supposed to be in the gunas. So therefore, the devotee is nirguna, beyond the gunas. So he should act beyond those, all those gunas, even beyond sattva, and therefore he can adjust to every situation, but in all these situations, this idea of acting on behalf of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu or Krishna is higher than all these other things. So we have to do what is appropriate to cultivate people and guide them out of the modes of generation. That requires a little intelligence. We can't be everybody the same. Everybody's in their level, so we have to speak to them and communicate with them so that they can understand what we're saying. And everybody communicates in different ways and accepts communication in different ways, so they can try to understand what that is and preach to them so they can grasp the main points.
But we were talking about how there were as a king, he was trying to control particular attached to that particular aspect. So there are certain services where you want to make sure that it is done. So as a manager, how to really pull the services in such a way that you're not attached, but still it's done properly. Because like for example, this COVID time you have to really enforce many rules. And devotees of yes may not comply with those rules, but we have to do it. So how to do it that it is your attached in terms of enforcing it and it's not affecting you as spiritually, but services done as
So individually this is not a problem. What we do is necessary to protect ourselves and protect others health wise and spiritually and on all levels. So we take all precautions in that regard. And as for others, we should be able to enforce it on others, and that's maybe even more difficult. That's when you can tell everybody else, you gotta do this, you gotta do that, you gotta do this, and they don't wanna do it. But, if they're devotees, then it's not too much of a problem, because, we can just rely on the authority. If the authority tells us to do this, they will too do it. Just reinforce the authority, that's all. I'm doing. You don't have to think about it too much. And everybody naturally should follow the authority. You can't say you don't want to follow authority. There's an authority structure there. So we just make sure that it's an authoritative rule coming from higher up, and we just enforce it, that's all.
Raj, our question is regarding how you said people live materially and at the end they do times of coming after time. So in 6th Canto of Bhagavad, explain how sinful people that then go to different hells for reformation. They come back, but because they're used to doing the same pattern, they'll do the same thing again and continue the same thing again. So how they can be break from the cycle?
People are slow learners. Life after life, and even this life, obviously, you see people don't learn. So We of course do country rules, but then some of the rules are favorable. Some of them are not actually in line with Varnashrama rules. So as much as follow Varnashrama rules. And so what about over and above the country rules, then we have Varnashrama rules to follow. And those rules are molded for different types of people. The Sudras have one type of rule, Vaishyas have another set of rules, Kshatriyas have another set of rules, and Brahmins have another set of rules, according to their capacity. So the Sudras are more less rules, because they can't follow as much, and the Brahmins have a lot of rules to follow. So that's the whole system, and gradually, life after life, even if they don't know what they're doing, and they follow all those rules, and gradually they get to the higher gunas and they appreciate, you know, the rules more, and they can follow the rules until they get to the brahmanical state, then they can understand how the body. So that's the gradual system of elevation by following Varnashrama. But in Bhagavad Gita, finally Krishna says, Sarvadharma Pratyajna, give up all of this. It's not going to work until you just surrender to me. So the only way of breaking the cycle then in Kali Yuga is don't depend on Varnashrama to do it, it can be in the system, but it's not the main process. The main process is surrender to Krishna. Somehow get them to the bhakti somehow or other. And of course, once you've done it, this doesn't mean the whole thing. So by that, so that's the introduction. So they hear it, even if they're not devotees, it will influence a little bit. If they need more exposure, they will get faith, they will get faith. And then they will begin to understand, and they'll start reading and accept the principles of Bhagavad Gita, and then they can practice spiritual life. But that's the only way in which they can get out of it.
From a Gyatra Sutra thing.
Yeah. From a Gyatra Sutra to Bhakti. And bypassing Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, and Asana Yoga, whichever two of you have
come to. Thank you. Just one more. You mentioned in the Chaitanya Prabhupada example of how in the spiritual form they hear and what they want to. Like for devotees, we say, okay, which book do you want to be in? Do you want to be in each book or do you want to be in the spiritual book? But like for people outside, for them the choice is, do you want to put both legs in the material book or one leg in either book? So it would be better for them to do one leg in each book rather than be two legs in the material book.
Well, of course, if you are really attached to the material world, you may say, okay, I'm not spiritual also, but ultimately, they end up in the material world. That's too strong for them. Nothing wrong with having a little bit of spiritual interest, but definitely they're not going to go very far. However, even in that position, by the act of superteaching whatever, and exposure, and eventually get a little more faith, until they get a little more commitment. So that's a natural commitment for such people, not a big deal.
I'm going to maybe hear from Jennifer's instruction to King Arjuna. It is quite analytical, Sankhya-like presentation is quite complex, and it's coming to Bhakti after quite a lot of presentation. Why such a complex presentation to come to Bhakti?
Oh, well, one, of course, is to, it's a way of preaching as opposed to Jadvara himself. He can't just introduce Rasa immediately. Of course, he's going to break his ego and things like that, so he condemns the material world and say, you know, hogs and dogs and things like this. just to make him realize that the whole material world is hopeless and then gets into a little bit of Atma and things like that. So that's actually happens in the Vedic literature or in general. First they preach, you're not the body, you're the Atma, as in Bhagavad Gita also. And then beyond that, we introduce gradually the idea of Supreme Lord and Bhakti. So the first stage is Atmagyan, and then we go to Bhakti afterwards. So that's the general procedure followed in the Upanishads also.
Maharaj, you mentioned about the determination to do Bhakti. Externally, when we see, we can be fixed in devotion service, doing the same service, but when we see internally, control the mind, in a sense, so internally it's easy to be determined in terms of mind control all the time. So one can control for some time, there can be failures. So how to deal with that? How one can be fixed internally?
Yeah. Well, so we're fixed externally, as that is a little progress. So then to go from that, the external to the internal, is not so difficult. If you can't even do the external, what's the internal? If you do the external practices, like I said, that's a good start. Based on that, then you can start working on the internal. Determination internal, you can say, is a matter of strength of faith. If you have that faith very strong, then this can inspire us to work internally to develop that determination. In other words, bhakti has two aspects, the external ones, that's where we engage our senses. But then included in the senses is the mind also. And with the mind, when you get into the internal aspect as well. But then the ultimate internal aspect is the jiva. And the internal aspect, first sentence, is the faith. The faith is not something in your mind. It's not something in your senses. It's actually the jiva. So that's your qualification. If the jiva is at a certain stage of having that faith, then we're qualified for practicing bhakti, which will manifest externally as activities, and using the voice and the eyes, etc. And internally, as you say, concentrating the mind in the form of Krishna smiling, meditation, etc. But then beyond that, we have that the atma itself, and its dedication and faith in the Supreme Lord. And that develops into, that's the internal aspect of bhakti of Anukulam Krishna Sivana, that we are serving Krishna favorably, with an affection. So that's coming from the atma itself. So in the beginning it's very little, it's manifested with faith and in the beginning of bhakti, but then that also has to be gradually cultivated. So that's the real internal aspect. And therefore when we do the bhakti, that affection from the atma or the jiva has to also be there, and it is. Then as you do the bhakti externally, it increases the internal aspect. So the two things will go together. Provided we pay attention to it.
Maharaj, is the faith one of the eight qualities of the spirit soul?
Faith?
Is one of the eight qualities of the spirit soul?
Eight qualities in?
In Bhagavad Gita Krishna commentary, he says that the eight properties or eight qualities of the spirit soul, which is similar to the qualities of
Oh, well, I think those eight qualities are the ones in the Upanishad. No hunger, no thirst, this, that, such a sankalpa, these qualities there. Would you say, also the spiritual qualities? Yeah, I suppose you can include faith within that also. That means to be faith will develop, that's a trust in the Supreme Lord, which will develop in the bhakti again.
Well, I'm different, no, because the way those questions are being asked. The way the questions have been asked, I was wondering, training somebody into bhakti is like training a wild horse. And when we're training a wild horse, we need to careful how we train that horse. And sometimes the horse may kick us, sometimes the horse listens to us, but ultimately the horse has to come under the control of the master. That's where the devotee becomes successful in the sense empowered by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, by the parampara, that he is able to reach out to another soul that he can take to the process. So in the process we find there is, as you said rightly, there is an external expression and an internal expression. Like King Ravana, his external, he is telling Jarabhara that the way he is doing is not okay, but his internal expression was maybe not appropriate, and therefore we find that the way he is saying, because Jarabhara was a high caliber devotee, he could ignore that. But that would happen in an ordinary situation. So therefore, we have the concept of the Radha Rishi
and the concept of a cruel king or a rude king. So someone could be like Aurangzeb to instruct and get things done, but then someone could be like Janakmala, who is a Radha Rishi. He can also get things done, but much more favorably.
So the king doesn't mean he's automatically representative of the Supreme Lord. Some are Asura, and some are Medhi, and some are actually the lords of the Lord. If they come in the line from a monk, then of course they're expected to be empowered by the Lord. Those who are not in the line are definitely not empowered, but they may be somewhat favorable, or some of the demonic kings, which Krishna came to destroy. So we have all sorts of people who are playing the role of Kshatriya. Some are qualified, some are not.